time is now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, April 4th. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. In tonight's news, Governor Evers signed a bill yesterday that establishes a grant program for flood research and prevention.
It's Autism Acceptance Month, and Wisconsin advocates are pushing for more inclusivity and accommodations.
A UW-Madison professor shares some safety tips ahead of Monday's partial solar eclipse.
And in the second half, a Milwaukee rapper's backstory, some house-hunting red flags, and a conversation with a documentary filmmaker.
All these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. President Biden has told Israel's Prime Minister that Washington's future policy in the Gaza conflict will depend on Israel taking new and immediate action to protect civilians and aid workers. The phone conversation with Benjamin Netanyahu was their first since Israel killed 7 humanitarian staff in Gaza on Monday, sparking international outrage. Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
This is the most strident tone the White House has taken so far on Israel. The statement put out after the call reflects the anger President Biden's officials have described about his mood after the World Central Kitchen strike. Mr. Biden effectively demanded that Israel ensures the protection of civilians in Gaza and lets in food aid. And the text released after his call with Mr. Netanyahu contained a warning that US policy with respect to Gaza would change if Israel doesn't immediately act on those demands. That is a significant shift.
Researchers conducting tests among the Yanomami indigenous group, who live in a region of Brazil awash with illegal gold mining, have found evidence of universal mercury contamination. The toxic metal is used by illegal miners to separate gold from sediment. Here's Leonardo Rocha.
The study led by the prestigious Fiocruz Institute examined hair samples and mouth swabs from almost 300 members of 9 villages in Brazil's Amazon region. All were found to have suffered contamination. More than 80% had mercury levels above acceptable limits. Experts say the Yanomami are suffering a devastating health crisis due to an explosion of illegal mining on their land.
As Argentina faces what's expected to be its worst ever dengue season, the country is facing a serious shortage of insect repellent. More details from our South America correspondent, Ione Wells.
A vaccine for dengue has been developed, but while its rollout is still in its early stages, most people still rely on preventative measures to avoid the virus. In Argentina, this is proving a problem as the country faces a serious shortage of repellents. Residents report that it is almost impossible to buy it, with many supermarkets and pharmacies displaying no repellent signs. In the few places where it is still available, especially online, resale prices are astronomical. The government has attributed the problem to a bottleneck and say it will be corrected in the coming days.
11 far-right MPs in Greece have been charged with electoral fraud, accused of using their parliamentary grouping, the Spartans, as a front for the banned Golden Dawn party. The jailed former Golden Dawn leader, Elias Kassithiaris, is also charged. The Spartans barely registered in opinion polls before last June's elections, but on being endorsed from his cell by Mr. Kassithiaris, the party won nearly 250,000 votes. BBC News. Reports on Iranian state media say the country's security forces have managed to release a number of hostages seized overnight in attacks in the southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan. They say 10 military personnel were killed, as well as 18 of the gunmen who had launched raids on 2 Revolutionary Guard posts and a Coast Guard station. A New York court has sentenced a British billionaire to 3 years probation and a $5 million fine for insider trading. Joe Lewis, the founder of private equity firm Tavistock Group, had pleaded guilty to passing stock tips to his girlfriend, friends and employees. Michelle Fleury reports from New York.
Despite federal sentencing guidelines calling for Mr. Lewis to serve as much as 2 years in prison, the judge agreed with prosecutors that the 87-year-old deserved leniency for his age, his significant health issues, and his decision to voluntarily travel to the US to accept responsibility for his crimes. Punishment may come in many forms, prosecutors wrote in a court filing earlier this week.
A former prison cellmate of the Islamist militant who carried out an attack at a Christmas market in the French city of Strasbourg in 2018 has told a Paris court he deeply regrets helping Sherif Shekat obtain the gun used in the incident. Audrey Monjailly was sentenced to a 30-year prison term on Wednesday after being found guilty of abetting murder in relation to a terrorist plot. British scientists believe they've found a new cause behind much of the damage asthma causes to the body. Research using mice and human lung tissue showed cells lining the airways are squeezed to destruction during an attack. They said this means asthma sufferers are more likely to get long-term inflammation and infections causing more attacks. BBC News.
This is Marcus Slayton and Christina Lefrain with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. The new district maps are likely to improve Democrats' prospects in the state legislature, but Democrats who are stepping away from their incumbency outnumber the Republicans yielding their seats. Topping that list is former Senate Minority Leader Melissa Agard of Madison, who plans to run for Dane County Executive. Three Assembly Democrats, Jimmy Anderson of Fitchburg, Samba Baldy of Madison, and Melissa Ratcliffe of Cottage Grove, will not seek re-election so they can run for Agard's seat. Across the aisle, Republican Dan Noodle of Germantown will give up his Senate post. That's because the new maps would require that he seek re-election against another Republican incumbent, Dewey Straubel of Saukville. Noodle has said he will run instead for the assembly seat held by Republican Janelle Brantgen of Menominee Falls. Meanwhile, the State Ethics Commission has recommended that Brantgen be criminally charged for violating campaign finance laws, alleging that she did so in 2022 while supporting Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's challenger, Adam Steen. And all 12 Democrats will not seek re-election in the state legislature compared to only 5 Republicans, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Today, a De Pere physician announced her run for Republican Michael Gallagher's vacant congressional seat on the Democratic ticket. Kristen Lyerly made the announcement at a Hinterland Brewing Company in Green Bay. She says that she sees a path to victory in the Republican-leaning 8th Congressional District, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Lyerly, an obstetrician-gynecologist, is an advocate for abortion access in Wisconsin. She lost a race for state assembly in 2020. Representative Gallagher has said he will leave Congress on April 19th. Several months earlier than his term was set to expire.
Elections officials in Racine County were silent today about the cause of a 20-hour delay in posting the vote count from Tuesday's election, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Complete results were finally posted to the county website around 5 p.m. Wednesday, according to WPR. A check of the county website this afternoon showed handwritten vote totals listed for municipal and school board races in the county, while presidential primary results appeared in printout form. A statement Wednesday from the county clerk's office said voting results had to be entered into, quote, another reporting system, unquote, so they could be posted online.
Hmong and Asian American history will be a mandatory part of the curriculum in K-12 schools. Under a bill Governor Tony Evers signed into law today, the Wisconsin State Journal reports. The measure expands provisions of a law that already requires lessons in Native American, African American, and Hispanic history. Wisconsin has about 200,000 people of Asian ethnicity, of whom about one-third are Hmong, according to the State Journal.
A motion to hold a public hearing on plans to build a gas-fired power plant in the city of Superior was rejected Wednesday by the City Council, reports the online news service Northern News Now. The motion for a hearing follows the City Planning Commission's rejection of a rezoning request for the plant known as the Maggi Trail Energy Trail Center. The project has a green light from state and federal regulators, but faced spirited opposition from local residents, tribes, and environmental groups.
Bird flu outbreaks have led to the mass destruction of millions of chickens in massive egg farms in recent years, but now dairy farmers are becoming aware that it can threaten their herds as well. The Wisconsin State Farmer newspaper reports that avian flu has been detected in dairy herds in Texas, New Mexico, Kansas, and Idaho. The disease was most recently found in Michigan after some cows were transported there from Texas. The most obvious symptom in cows is a drastic drop-off in milk production, often accompanied by fever, loss of appetite, and diarrhea. Pneumonia can follow as a secondary disease, the newspaper reports. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Governor Evers signed a bill into law yesterday that seeks help Wisconsin communities study and prepare for future floods and to preserve the state's wetlands. Local governments can now apply for grants to assess flood flows and floodplain hydrology and to create restoration projects. Reporter Sarah Gabler has more.
Over the last 10 years, Wisconsin communities experienced nearly $365 million in flood-related damages, reports the Wisconsin Towns Association, a group that supported a bipartisan bill that Governor Evers signed yesterday. The new law creates a pre-disaster flood resilience grant program. And now, local governments can apply for up to $300,000 in assessment grants and up to $250,000 in implementation grants. Sarah Smith, Dane County Board Supervisor for the City of Monona, said that flood risks are only going to increase.
Certainly, Dane County residents face significant flooding risk, as do people all over the state of Wisconsin. Flooding is our number one climate risk in our state, and it's only going to be increasing as we see wetter and wetter seasons. The increased precipitation that climate modeling has shown for our state is a concern and something that everybody should be aware of.
Yet one of the greatest barriers to flood prevention is simple awareness. Many people don't know that they live in a floodplain or that they could benefit from flood insurance, which isn't covered under homeowners insurance. Wisconsin law requires that property sellers disclose if they are aware that the property is located in a floodplain. But there is no specific requirement to disclose whether a property is mandated to have flood insurance. That's according to the National Research Defense Council, which gives Wisconsin a grade of D for inadequate flood disclosure laws. Meanwhile, the existing federal flood maps have serious problems. Tim Palmer, author of Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis, tells WORT that floodplain maps are often based on outdated and limited data. Palmer says other problems compromise flood maps.
There's been political influence on the final maps that get adopted at the local level because, of course, the whole development industries don't want to be heavily regulated. So they try to influence the maps at that stage of their development. The standard of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, of a 100-year flood for planning purposes is far too low. There should be at least a 500-year flood.
That makes it hard for individuals to assess their flood risk. And floods can impact you whether you live in a floodplain or not, says Smith.
A significant amount of claims for the National Flood Insurance Program come from outside of the mapped floodplain. So flooding risk is not specific only to those areas, and people can get coverage for flood insurance and also may want to make investments in flood resiliency, whether they live in a mapped floodplain or not.
That's because you might be impacted by an upstream issue, says floodplain manager David Fowler.
And that gets worse because if you design, let's say you designed in the 80s for your rivers, et cetera, and then development occurs up in the watershed out in Waukesha County, Washington County, Ozaukee, to use Milwaukee as an example, that increases the amount of water coming into us. That's why it's important that in southeast Wisconsin, they have strong stormwater management rules now. When they put in a subdivision, you'll see all those stormwater ponds.
From the individual level to the state level, preparation pays off, says Smith.
Some FEMA studies have shown that $6 are saved in disaster recovery for every $1 invested in disaster prevention and mitigation.
Flood prevention efforts are especially important in small communities like those in Ashland County, where repeated floods are taking their toll. Jennifer Westernhauser, policy liaison for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, says that the new law will make it possible for these small communities to study their wetlands.
One of the things that we've experienced up there is that many local governments are really kind of spinning their wheels with the flood events. They've had a lot of different damaging flood events in 16 and 18. They might see an area of repeated damage and not have the tools and resources to really understand what's happening with the flood, what's happening with the water in that location, or the erosion, what's the condition of wetlands and floodplains and channels upstream.
To find out if you live in a floodplain, you can visit floodsmart.gov or visit reducefloodrisk.org, a website created by the Association of State Floodplain Managers, to find other resources on preparation, mitigation, and insurance. For WORT News, I'm Sarah Gabler.
It's now 6:16, and you're listening to live local news on WORT. April is Autism Acceptance Month. Federal data show the medical community is seeing more children diagnosed with autism. And many adults are on the spectrum too, even if their symptoms don't always appear obvious. Wisconsin advocates hope these trends spur community-driven efforts for greater acceptance and inclusiveness. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
The CDC says 1 in 36 children around the U.S. has autism spectrum disorder. Rates are much higher than a decade ago, and support organizations hope Wisconsin communities do more to make individuals feel welcome, including adults on the spectrum. April is Autism Acceptance Month. Not only do advocates want to empower those with a diagnosis to live their fullest possible lives, but they also ask those around them to learn more about it. Katie Hess of the Autism Society of Greater Wisconsin says there are some key practices to keep in mind.
Really what we're looking for is for people just to be open-minded and patient and understanding.
And that acceptance doesn't happen only at home or school. Workplaces also are encouraged to foster more inclusiveness, with nearly 60% of people with autism now employed after receiving vocational services. Their advocates say these individuals have many strengths, and asking them about their needs creates a better environment for them. Symptoms of autism can vary widely for each person on the spectrum, including how they interact with others. Hess says whether the individual is considered high need or low need, having the public pay more attention to the evolution of this disorder is vital.
We're learning new information all the time, so certainly reach out to your local chapter, your Autism Society, ask questions.
Her chapter will soon begin offering a training program to organizations about how to become more autism-friendly. That includes being able to identify a person on the autism spectrum and how to best offer ways to help if they disclose their diagnosis. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The time is now 6:20 p.m., and you're listening to live artisanal local news on WORT. The solar eclipse is on Monday, and while Madison isn't in the path of totality, the moon will obscure almost 90% of the sun around 2:10 p.m. But how can you watch this rare event safely? UW-Madison's Dr. Mikhail Katz is an expert on optics and photonics. He shared some advice with our news producer, Faye Parks, earlier this afternoon.
So it's both compelling, just kind of from an experience perspective, but also I think it's a very strong visual example of how we can predict the future with the tools of science.
Thank you for joining me, Mikhail.
Thanks so much for having me.
So to start, can you walk us through your area of expertise at UW-Madison? How does it relate to eclipse viewing?
I'm a faculty member in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. My expertise is in optics and photonics, which is the science of light. So how light interacts with different materials, how to make imaging systems, structures for absorbing light, detecting light, protecting sensitive detectors from high-intensity light, and so forth. So I'm certainly not an expert on eclipses, but in the context of this eclipse, one thing that's quite important is to protect your eyes, which are, if you like, very sensitive detectors, very sensitive cameras, and of course, they're very precious as well. So we need to have the protection in place to make sure that you can view the eclipse safely. Really, what you're looking for is to try to make sure that the high intensity of the sun doesn't overwhelm your eyes and doesn't do damage, which is a core concept in optics and photonics.
We won't be in the path of totality for next week's solar eclipse. But then I'm wondering when, if you're in the total eclipse, is it safe to view or is it always lingering light that could be harmful?
In complete totality, looking at the eclipse with your bare eyes is safe. We, unfortunately, in Madison, will not get that. I believe that we'll get up to 90% of the sun being blocked, but there is never going to be a time in Madison during this eclipse that it's safe to look directly at it with the unaided eye. If you happen to be in, or you're going to go into the area where there is a totality for a few minutes, there will be an opportunity to look at the completely eclipsed sun unaided. Hopefully what you'll see is a little shimmer of the corona, which is a region that's just kind of on the outside of the sun that won't be blocked by the moon, but the entire surface of the sun will be. And that time when the moon blocks the entire surface of the sun from view, that's the only safe time to look at the sun with the unaided eye.
Just so folks understand, what possible effects could happen if you look at the sun unaided?
In general, the biggest safety risk is something that's called solar retinopathy. So there is a class of eye-related injuries which come from actually from high-intensity blue light primarily. So kind of in the range that begins with kind of the edge of the ultraviolet and going up kind of through the blue part of the visible spectrum, that part of sunlight, if it's very intense, has the potential to damage your retina, and that could be short-term damage, or if you stare at it long enough, it could even be long-term damage. So this is something that doesn't happen instantly. So for example, if you just glance at the sun for a split second, nothing is going to happen. In fact, we do that all the time when we're outside and the sun is out. But if you stare at it, then there is the potential for the solar retinopathy damage.
So how can our listeners view the eclipse safely? What are some tools that they can rely on?
So the most kind of recommended tool is something that's called eclipse glasses. I think they're sold in a lot of places. The eclipse is coming, so I think you can find them in various stores. You can order them online. I think there's still a little bit of time to order them. They're also being given away by various organizations. They're not super expensive. And they're essentially little solar filters that attenuate the light coming from the sun by a lot. So generally speaking, in order for eclipse glasses to satisfy the appropriate kind of standard of safety, it has a number. I have it written down here. It's ISO 12312-2. It's the standard for how much glasses should attenuate light in order for it to be totally safe. And that attenuation ratio is very large. So when you look through eclipse glasses, you see a solar intensity that's more than 30,000 times less than if you look at the sun with the unaided eye. So that's probably the easiest and best way to look at the eclipse safely. And, you know, through eclipse glasses, you can stare at it all you want and there's no risk of damage, as long as the eclipse glasses are legit.
And just to make sure, run-of-the-mill sunglasses aren't sufficient in this case. Is that right?
That's right. So sunglasses typically attenuate light by maybe a factor of 2, maybe a factor of 10. It depends on the strength of the sunglasses. But what you need in order to view the eclipse completely safely is an attenuation of something like 30,000 or more. So that's a substantial difference, an attenuation of 30,000 versus an attenuation of 2 or 5 or 10. So sunglasses are completely insufficient for safe viewing of an eclipse or looking at the sun in general for any reasonable duration of time. There are other ways in which you can view the eclipse as well. So one of my favorite kind of tricks or concepts in optics that is relevant to viewing the eclipse is something that's called a pinhole camera. A pinhole camera, maybe some people have made it with a shoebox. You kind of poke a hole in a shoebox and then your image gets projected inside and you can look in. During the eclipse, you can take any object. So you could take a piece of cardboard or, you know, anything that you could poke a hole through. You poke a little hole and then you hold it over, for example, the ground or over a white sheet of paper, and an image of the sun is going to get formed on whatever it is that's lying on the ground that's below this little screen with the hole. This can even form completely naturally. So I think most likely people listening to this won't be in a place where there's a lot of leaves on the trees. We've had a little last gasp of winter yesterday. I don't think there's any leaves on the trees yet, but on occasions when you can have a solar eclipse that is shining through a tree with a lot of leaves in it, you essentially have a lot of little pinholes that get formed by those leaves, and you end up with a bunch of images of the eclipse on the ground. So if you Google, for example, you know, eclipse through a tree or eclipse through leaves, it's a really beautiful effect that you can observe. But, you know, you can always make it by taking any sort of solid screen and poking a hole through it and then holding it over the ground.
So why do you think that people find eclipses so fascinating?
It's a really novel experience for a lot of people. I've never seen a total eclipse. I'm actually going to drive down to Indiana to try to catch it. I'm really excited. What I've heard from people that have been in a total eclipse is that it's a dramatic experience where, you know, you hear the sounds of the animals change, the sounds of birds and so forth. It's also, I think, conceptually very fascinating because it's something that we can predict, you know, years in advance, decades in advance. It's kind of the proof that we can use science to predict the future, that nature follows the laws of physics. This is something that would have been completely magical to, you know, people from earlier generations who didn't have access to these tools. But, you know, we can now predict exactly where it's going to be, what it's going to look like. And so it's both compelling just kind of from an experience perspective, but also I think it's a very strong visual example of how we can predict the future with the tools of science.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think you should all hope for good weather.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Mikhail.
Thanks so much, Faye.
That was Dr. Mikhail Katz, an associate professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. He's also an expert on optics and photonics and shared some advice on safe eclipse viewing ahead of next Monday's astronomical event.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Please stay with us. We've got lots more stories coming up.
We hear from a Milwaukee rapper's backstory, learn some red flags to look out for when house hunting, and interview a director ahead of this year's Wisconsin Film Festival.
But first, we'll take a quick break, check in on some world headlines, and we'll be right back.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bernie's Rock Shop, located at 901 East Johnson, and our new shop, Bernie's on Park, at 636 South Park in Madison. We offer handmade silver jewelry as well as unique mineral, crystal, and fossil specimens from around the world. Store hours and more information available at berniesrockshop.com.
Hi, I'm Mel from The Mel and Floyd Show. Come on down and join Floyd and me Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival live show. This year we'll be broadcasting from the Bartell Theater, 116 East Mifflin Street. We'll be interviewing our usual assortment of interesting people from the fest, including directors, actors, writers, people from the craft services table, and if we have some time to fill, maybe some interesting-looking passersby. We'll cover raging film controversies such as popcorn, butter or no butter, seating, center or aisle, and how to properly shush a loud patron. Heady stuff? It certainly is. Yes, it's going to be quite the wild ride indeed. So let's all go to the lobby. Come join the fun with Mel and Floyd at the Bartell Theater Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival remote broadcast.
BBC News. The Israeli government says it will allow more humanitarian aid to enter Gaza after a phone call between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the US President Joe Biden. It said it will reopen the Erez crossing point into northern Gaza on a temporary basis. Researchers have found evidence of universal mercury contamination in the Brazilian Yanomami indigenous group. They live in an area awash with illegal gold mining, where the toxic metal is used to separate gold from sediment. Argentina is facing a serious shortage of insect repellent ahead of what's expected to be its worst ever dengue season. The government's blamed a bottleneck in supply. Congress in Peru has voted against opening impeachment proceedings against President Boluarte, who is being investigated for alleged corruption. 11 far-right MPs in Greece have been charged with electoral fraud, accused of using their parliamentary grouping, the Spartans, as a front for the banned Golden Dawn Party. Reports on Iranian state media say the country's security forces have managed to release a number of hostages seized overnight in attacks in the southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan. 10 military personnel were reportedly killed, as well as 18 of the gunmen. A New York court has sentenced a British billionaire to 3 years probation and a $5 million fine for insider trading. Joe Lewis, the founder of private equity firm Tavistock Group, had pleaded guilty. British researchers using mice and human lung tissue have demonstrated that cells lining the airways are squeezed to destruction during an asthma attack. This means asthmatics become trapped in a cycle of inflammation and repeated attacks. BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with co-host Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us.
In this edition of Out of D-Box, host D-Star sits down with hip-hop maestro Calvin Bellamy, better known as Cuckoo Cal. Cuckoo Cal shines a spotlight on local talents and the unwavering support of the Milwaukee hip-hop community.
What's up, everybody? This is your host, D-Star, here with
Cuckoo Cow.
Cuckoo Cow, man. All right, so check this out. I was just thinking about this yesterday. I said, Milwaukee is like Gotham City right now. Boosie said he's the mayor, right? Shout out to Boosie.
Shout out to Boosie.
Man, that's a good dude. Baby Drew said that he's
the ghetto hero.
The ghetto hero.
Baby Drew, most definitely the ghetto hero.
The ghetto hero. So would that make you the godfather?
I'm just Cal, man. I'm just cuckoo running crazy all around this month.
So yeah. For the people that don't know you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name is Calvin Bellamy. It's my government. They call me Cuckoo Cal, man. I started rapping in 1995. Before then, you know what I'm saying? I was a DJ. You know what I'm saying? Most of the DJs that's on the radio right now, back in the day, we was doing basement parties together. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I came out with a record in 2001, a hit record that went national called My Projects. Before then, I had two albums out before then. First album I put out was called Game. And I'm standing on a checkerboard CD. I wish we could have Photoshop was out then because that cover was looking kind of crazy. Then my second album that kind of, you know what I'm saying, took me to the next level. was called Walking Dead. But The Walking Dead, I had a lot of features on there. Mac 10, Spice 1, The Outlaws. It was a few people. I'm getting old, y'all, so my memory's kind of bad. Forgive me. But yeah, Walking Dead was the second album that kind of led to, that was in 1998, and that kind of led to the projects deal.
Take us through the journey. You started off in Germany.
Yep, I started off. Actually, okay, we can go back kind of like the documentary. I was an Army brat. I was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. From there, I moved to El Paso, Texas. From there, to Baumholder, Germany. Baumholder, Germany, Richmond, Virginia. And then my daddy retired here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, teaching ROTC at UWM.
A lot of the times when people make it or when people, you know, start a music career in rap, they say certain things that's not true, right? So they'll say, oh, man, I had to hustle to eat. I had to do this. I had to do that. You are like one of the only people that I've ever heard really keep it real and say, I didn't have to do that. I didn't have to be in the streets. I had a silver spoon. I went left, but I didn't have to.
Yep, that's true. Because, you know, like I said, I was an Army brat, man. You know what I'm saying? I didn't know nothing about the streets till I was like 12 years old when I moved to Milwaukee. And I still didn't know nothing about it then. And I stayed out in the suburbs when I moved here. And, I just kept running to the ghetto, man, because, you know, I just was curious, man.
So, yeah, I really appreciate that because it's like our parents work hard, you know what I mean, to provide and you know, try to put you in a good situation. And for them, people to turn around and be like, well, I had to do this. You're like, man, where was I? What are you talking
about?
Yeah,
my mother, like I said in the documentary, she didn't respect none of that because she was like, you weren't from the projects. I wasn't.
Right.
By the time that song came out, I couldn't stay out the projects.
Yeah. But yeah, I remember you said that your mother didn't respect it until she seen you on Soul Train.
On Soul Train. She was in love with Don Cornelius. I think when I was younger, I used to see my daddy frowning up every time she up the TV looked like she want to make love to the TV, see Don Cornelius.
Yeah. With that success of that song, kind of take me through the impact that it had on the city of Milwaukee.
The impact the city had on me, man. It really tripped me out, man. It wasn't just a song. It wasn't one of my favorites. Like Steve-O said in the documentary, it wasn't one of his favorites. It just was a song. Like you know, Steve-O said, I had it in my head. You know what I mean? And then Hank came along with the beat. You know what I'm saying? I had the chorus and stuff in my head for a couple of years. And Hank came along with the beat. You know, I'm always listening to beats. And I just going through stuff that I wrote in my head but never, you know, had a track for it to, you know, go along with. And Hank came along with that beat. You know, I had the opportunity to lay it. And first people we pitched was Jive Records. You know what I'm saying? They flew out here a couple of times, and then we flew out there. And, you know, it ended up in Tommy Boy's hands, though.
The song takes off. Things start happening really, really fast.
I'm talking about from day to night, from night to day, man. I never thought it was. You know, I've always loved music, period. You know what I'm saying? Like I said, I was DJing first, and I never thought I'd become a rapper. You know what
was
I mean?
Your DJ name?
DJ Cool Cal B.
Okay.
Yeah, DJ Cool Cal B. Yep, that was my DJ name back in the day, man. I'm going to give a shout-out to my man Hitman, too. He's going battling some cancer right now. We used to DJ side by side back in the day with Dr. B, the Fresh G's, Reggie Brown's, all them. Yeah, be going through some stuff right now, stage 4 cancer. Big shout out to Hitman Tommy B.
Absolutely. First of all, shout out to the Milwaukee Hip Hop Museum.
Big shout out.
Big shout out. They let us come in here. They let us record, and they just do an awesome job of curating hip hop, not only just for Milwaukee, but for the entire country.
For the entire country. Yeah, I'm kind of embarrassed because this is my first time here, man, but this is really nice, man. Really nice, man. Y'all got to come check it out if you're from the Mill. I don't care where you're from. You come to Milwaukee, you got to come check it out, man.
Absolutely. You know, we got some of your projects on the wall that you had an opportunity to. Can you tell us a little bit about?
Yeah, she got up here All or Nothing. I think that's when I was mad at the label Infinite right there.
Or they was
they
mad at you.
They came up with that title. We were mad at each other. Yep. Big shout out to Infinite Recording, Steve-O.
Shout out to Steve-O.
Yep. Big shout out. Got the projects, The Walking Dead. All or Nothing. Yeah, I think that was the last. That was the last album I did with Infinite called All or Nothing. I believe that's where the title came from. It's going to be All or Nothing. Yep, real tough.
And they said they had the official press release right here for Tommy, my projects.
Yeah, Tommy Boy. Yeah, I actually wasn't signed to Tommy Boy. It was actually Infinite. And, you know, we did a 360. I was signed with Infinite 45. Big shout out to Ralph Smalls and Steve-O, Infinite 45 Recordings.
Absolutely. City of Milwaukee right now, kind of turned up. What are some of the biggest differences that you see back then from now?
In the hip-hop scene, man, you got a lot of... I just like music, you know what I'm saying? I believe the only type of music we can do was country western. I think I could make a nice country western song, you know what I mean?
Right.
I just like music, you know, them 88 keys, good music. But we got a lot of young cats out right now, you know what I'm saying? Shout out to Blackout Entertainment, KB the Playmaker, you know what I'm saying? It's a lot of young talent out here, man. That's really good. In my era, it was kind of... It's saturated right now. You know what I'm saying? The game is real saturated, but it's a lot of good talent here in Milwaukee.
Does anybody stand out to you?
It's so many. I you know what? I don't want to just name one. Like I'm gonna bring up this interview that me and Drew had with Homer Blow. Shout out Homer Blow.
Shout out to Homer, man. I've been trying to get in contact with Homer, man. I like Homer and everything that he's doing. So
yep, and what he's done for the city, you know, hip hop period in Milwaukee, he's done a lot. Big shout out to Homer Blow. But me and Drew was in an interview with him, and so he would ask us both the same question. You know what I'm saying? One at a time. And I remember he asked Drew this question first. And this is the only question that he didn't ask me. He asked Drew, like, what is one of your favorite songs that you recorded? And Drew replied, Homer, you got any children? And he was like, yeah, how many kids you got? He said, like, three of them. He said, like, he's like, do you like one of your kids better than the other?
Right, right.
And he was like, no, I love them all the same. Drew said, that's how I feel about my music. They all my babies.
Right, you know right.
I
mean?
So it'd be hard for me to just pick one, man. I could just say we got a lot of talent right here in this era, man.
That was D-Star sitting down with rapper Cuckoo Cal. Check out the Out of the Box podcast to hear the rest of their conversation.
Do you know when it's time to run away? On this week's The House Always Wins, Allie and John tell you some red flags to watch for when house hunting.
I call it housework, cause it's light work.
What you done here?
I'ma throw shapes, filling the bass till my feet hurt.
Hey!
I call it housework.
Hello, I'm John.
And I'm Allie, and welcome to The House Always Wins, where you can learn cool stuff about your house.
We love cool stuff. You know, the blooming of spring flowers marks the beginning of house shopping season, and house shopping season in Dane County can get really competitive, with houses going on the market these days and getting multiple competing offers and offers on top of offers, sometimes within days and even hours.
Yeah, and so that can put a lot of pressure on a home shopper to take a quick look at a place, make an offer, and often give up their right to an inspection.
Oof.
And I've made offers on homes with less time and consideration than I've bought raincoats, basically.
Well, sure, but it was a really good raincoat, right?
Oh,
I mean,
100%.
It's my understanding that given higher interest rates, the market has cooled a bit since those crazy times of the last, I don't know, honestly, 3 years. We would always recommend having a home that you are planning to purchase inspected by a state-licensed home inspector. They can alert you to a wide range of home issues, and they can suggest which ones merit further investigation, and which items you need to take care of immediately, and which ones you could maybe let go, and which ones would be like, oh, heck no, we're not buying this house.
That's exactly what they do, and generally the price for a home inspection is under $1,000, so super worthwhile investment when we're talking about a $300,000-$400,000 purchase.
Right.
We thought it might be helpful to discuss which of those major issues that you might be able to observe on an initial walkthrough that should just lead you to turn tail and walk out of that house.
Well, you know, for me, one of the first ones that comes to mind is if you just drive up and you look at the roof and you see like scalloping of the shingles and maybe even some areas that might look like they might even have holes and maybe raccoons are moving in and starting a family, that oftentimes just from the street might be the first good clue of like driving away.
Right. Sometimes the animals are coming in from underneath the edge of the roof. It's the area we call the cornice, but they... Mm-hmm. animals coming in there, boy, you got some problems. And the problem with seeing a little bit of rot is that there's always a lot more rot.
Yeah, isn't that like to say about in New York City, if you can see a couple of rats, there's another 100 friends that you can't see?
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of like that, honestly, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that's just showing up. You haven't even walked inside yet, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you don't even have to get out of the car, so that's nice for that.
Mm.
But let's say you walk in the house and, you know, one of the first things I would do is head down to the basement.
Right.
And most homes around here have basements.
It's true.
Frankly, I know basements can be creepy.
Mm.
You got to be brave.
Got to be brave.
Uh-huh.
You can do it.
But you head down to the basement and a lot of times you can see that there's been some flooding issues and it's not super uncommon around here. There might be some stains on the wall and sort of roughly a horizontal line.
Right.
So that tells you sort of how high the water gets.
And if it's within 2 inches of the top of the foundation, it might be time to walk away.
For sure. You might see mold.
That's a bathtub.
Yeah, you might see mold. And honestly, if it's freshly painted, it's possible that they're trying to hide something.
That's always that's a red flag. If the basement is all freshly painted, what you trying to hide there?
Exactly. Sometimes there's even standing water. And there's a lot of reasons that basements might get wet. For example, a clogged floor drain could be the issue. So that's a simple repair by a Roto-Rooter type company and can be fixed for a few hundred dollars.
Right. So it may not be the killer thing, but also, you know, in my house is included in this. Some basements are just sitting below the level of the groundwater. And it can lead to seasonal flooding, especially during the spring thaw. You know, the ground is letting all its moisture out. You get excess rain. That can lead to considerable flooding, depending on the situation. That might be a home that just needs a drainage system and a sump pump to pump that all out of there. And granted, that's not cheap, and it's definitely disruptive, but you could do it for $10,000 or less. It's definitely not the end of the world. They come in, they break up around the edges, they put in drain tile and a sump pit and a sump in. It's not bad. In fact, you had that done, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, and it works brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view, and I had it done in my rental property for, it was under $5,000 actually.
Wow.
I wouldn't call that runaway territory, but you'd want to address that. So when water, on the other hand, is coming in through large cracks in the floor or foundation, then you might start talking about larger dollar amounts, like well in excess of $10,000. And one of the realities is that when you have a large area of concrete, like you have a concrete floor or a foundation wall, they do tend to crack some.
They do.
Especially when they haven't been designed with expansion joints. Concrete will find its own way to create expansion joints.
Sure
it will
does.
Just crack. And so those types of cracks are often pretty small, less than a quarter inch wide. And you might see some of these types of cracks in the floor or coming off the corners of the basement windows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not unusual. And if they're really small and thin and doesn't look like they're going past a couple feet long, you know, may not be too much to worry about. On the other hand, when those cracks are larger than a quarter inch or so, or when the two sides of the crack are clearly offset, so there's movement, like significant movement in both the floor and the foundation, then you might want to start looking closer. And if the cracks are running horizontally, like you got a straight horizontal line and it's a block foundation, and it happens to be right about at, the ground level outside, that can be a big old red flag. And that is potentially a failing foundation. And the ground outside is soaking up moisture and putting all kinds of pressure on that block wall. And it's not going to stop putting that pressure on.
Yeah, and that can happen to a concrete wall, too.
It can.
And
boy, howdy,
that tells you that there's a failure going on in that foundation. Now we're talking about a very expensive repair.
Yeah, my first house, I did this. I went in with my eyes wide open. I knew what I was getting into. It was a block foundation. Horizontal crack all the way across. But I had no overhangs, no gutters. So water was pouring off the roof, soaking up the soil, and it shoved it in so I could see it. And it was just one wall. So we got a great deal. I got $10,000 knocked off the price. And basically what I did is I evacuated the family one weekend and I excavated on the outside and I used 3 20-ton jacks and some luck and good wishes, and I cranked it and pushed the wall back to flat after grinding out the joints, and then I poured concrete columns on the outside with re-rod running inside. It was complicated. And frankly, it's not a project for the typical homeowner.
It's not a project for me.
Well, I was in my 30s, and you're right. I don't think I would do that today. I'd be like, we'll go look at something else for sure.
Yeah.
But it was a big deal. And if you had to pay a contractor to do all that, that would be pretty expensive.
It's definitely five figures in the upper five figures. So that's runaway territory.
It certainly is. Yeah. So it's funny. So it seems like we focus on the roof and the foundations. Everything in between, who knows? You know, those are some of the biggest issues we would probably say you need to definitely run away from. You know, there's other things. There could be electrical issues and plumbing issues that we probably just don't have time to get into today. Maybe we'll get into some of the other areas sometime soon in the future. But until then,
if you have a question about carpentry, home improvement, or what else?
Houses.
Okay. Until then, if you have a question about carpentry or home improvement, send us an email at thehousealwayswins@wortfm.org. But I'm going to throw shade if I don't get paid for this housework. I call it housework.
It's now 6:50 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Director and cinematographer Wendy Schneider says she wants to share stories that touch her audience on a deep and personal level. Her documentary Angels of Dirt tells the story of professional flat track racer Charlotte Kanes. While it's being screened this Sunday at the Barrymore Theater as part of the Wisconsin Film Festival. In this archival edition of Radio Chipstone, Schneider tells feature contributor Jennifer Fields about the process of filmmaking and the contagious fearlessness of the film's heroine.
I started to do Angels of Dirt back in 2006 on a total whim. I had a camera at my disposal. I had been to a few races at Aztaland, a local dirt track in Lake Mills, Wisconsin, and watching young girls race was a total turn-on. I was really excited to see the fearlessness, the sense of self, the self-determination that they then brought to the sport, and how inclusive the sport was with young girls and boys. So I just started filming interviews, and the first person that I met was Charlotte Kanes. She gave me my first interview. She was 9 years old. She sat in a lawn chair with a Red Bull, and she told me that what she wanted to do with her life was become a professional flat tracker, and that's what she did. That day, I met her father. I met her friends. I met other female racers, and I felt like my level of intrigue was astounding, and the energy that I had around following these young racers was undeniable for me. And so that's how the project started, and it continued for 3 years as I followed Charlotte and other young women racing. And I learned about the race community. I was observant. I was immersed. I was all the many things that happen to you when you are just spending your time in a new crowd and with a new group of people. And then I put the project on hold after having a traumatic car accident and stepped away from not only the project, but a lot of things for about a year. After that, the Smart Studios project entered my life, and that felt immediate and like a great opportunity. I didn't realize it was going to take 7 years. Almost to the day that the Smart Studios project left my life, I found out that Charlotte had crashed and lost her life in Santa Rosa, California, racing the last race of her professional career. At that point, the story of the film, which was initially just celebrating a lot of different female racers, this story now had a very significant foundation to be invested in, which was Charlotte's life and who Charlotte was and is.
When you were a fan of the racing, had you experienced that sort of near-death exhilaration? Had you felt that as a witness? And then, if so, Did that change after your accident, and did you get closer to Charlotte in some sense with having that experience?
Having a traumatic experience, which was for me an accident on the highway, and the person who was helping me on the highway was then killed on the highway while they were helping me. And so it was the trauma of the accident linked with another trauma of somebody losing their life who was assisting me. That has remained completely unrelated to the story or the relationship that I have with Angels of Dirt. It explains to me why I stepped away. I just was not able to invest. It explains a lot of things about that time and what I needed to do to take care of myself with trauma. And I learned a lot about trauma and recovery because it took me so long to recover from that. So I think that while I don't relate it to the story or it doesn't shift anything in the story for me, having the experience of trauma recovery is a gift that I, regardless of the film, I feel like it was a very valuable experience. Now, having gone through trauma recovery, nobody looks through the lens of trauma at motorcycle racing. You look through the lens of life force. So that is, Charlotte was life force. And everything around her passing has touched life force more than it has touched trauma. Although the level of trauma, you can't really decide what that is for anybody, but it exists. And it doesn't exist in an elephant in the room kind of way. It is very acknowledged how much we all miss and are hurting around the loss of this incredible person to all of us. And everybody feels it differently, expresses it differently, but it's all connected to a real love that we have.
It seems to me sitting here is a bittersweet sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The privilege of having met her, having watched her, and then the loss of her. Mm-hmm. Is there a putting on of a director producer's hat mm-hmm. and stepping away from that? Or do you want the audience to get that connection with you in the film?
I don't know about connecting, because everybody's going to do that. Everyone is going to connect differently to Charlotte, to racing, to the notions of love and loss and life and fearlessness. Everyone's going to have their own visceral or guttural, whatever it is, emotional connection to those themes, which are universal in the film. It's important for me for people to know Charlotte in a way that is driven by her voice and her experience. Now, some of that will be anecdotal through people telling stories about Charlotte, but then some of it will be actual Facebook posts of hers or a journal entry, not a journal, but a writing of hers or a comment that she made to somebody else in an email that I might retrieve. So I've made it clear to a small circle of folks within Charlotte's community that this is important to me, is to bring her into the center of the film as much as possible. And as a filmmaker, I have to sort out ways that I'm going to do that. You know, the tagline to the film is, "The freedom to be fearless is every girl's right." And I take that very seriously as a woman filmmaker who is usually working on a project that's got an activist component or a consciousness component. I feel like Charlotte represents a young woman who was given full access to pursue her own level of fearlessness, her own level of courage. And she was mentored, she was supported, she was ushered by a community that believed in her. And who she was and who she is to us is partly the result of the community and family that support you and help you on your way. I feel that now it is vital to represent stories of women who are not necessarily breaking the molds, but they are walking their truth, they're living their truth at any cost. And with Charlotte, the cost was just access, and that's what she had. And I think that it's an important message around the film.
That was Jennifer Fields sitting down with filmmaker Wendy Schneider. Schneider's documentary, Angels of Dirt, is screening this Sunday at the Barrymore Theater.
And that's a wrap for WORT's Live Local News at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporter tonight was Sarah Gabler. Special thanks to feature contributors D. Star, John Stephanie and Ali Barani, and Jennifer Fields. Nate Carlin engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Ms. Shali Pippen is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Listening to WORT Madison. I am your host, Allison Jacoby, and this is the Perpetual Notion Machine. In the last few weeks, we heard from some UW researchers on some current phenomena within the atmosphere and on our planet. Today, however, we are diverting our focus to the methods of communicating these difficult topics. Today, we are joined virtually by Callie Moore from University of Montana. She's a paleontologist and collections manager at the university, but also a co-host of the PBS YouTube show Eons. So in a few moments, we will not only take a look into the complexities of communicating science effectively, but look further into what you, the listener, can do to better understand and engage with these topics and discussions. So Callie, could you start by telling us about how you first became interested in paleontology and your journey into becoming essentially a fossil librarian?
Yeah, I was a dino kid. I loved dinosaurs. I loved fossils when I was a kid. And so it was just kind of, I never got out of it. So I just kind of went forward with my love of paleontology. And although I did like dinosaurs, I didn't live in